and the plateau. I told David, facetiously, we'd call this the top 10 sites in the Karak Plateau, but it's not top 10 as much as it is 10 sites that I happen to have reasonably acceptable illustrations for, very practical reason. And also I picked sites that would be, I think, interesting because of the variety of periods represented and the variety of architectural archaeological remains. So there are several reasons for choosing these 10 sites. Out of the 585 sites between Wadis Mujib and Hessa, these are not necessarily the top 10 in terms of historical importance, population, or economic clout, or whatever. They just happen to be 10 I picked because I like them, and I have, as I said, some illustrations of them. All right, so we're going to be down in this region here, in the bottom right-hand corner of the map. This is the Karak Plateau between Wadi Mujib and Wadi Hessa. About 50 miles by 25 miles our area that we're dealing with down there. And as I've said, we have about 585 sites. And so I picked 10, and we'll go through them tonight rather quickly. The first one I'd like to go to, and watch how sneaky this is, it's actually a two-part site, so really going to be 11 before we're finished tonight. The site of Balua, located on the southern side of Wadi Khuri, where it runs into Wadi Balua. And then on the northern side of Wadi Khuri is another site, and we simply call the one on the north Early Bronze Balua and the one on the south Iron Age Balua. This is just to the east of the so-called King's Highway, as it would go on up then to where we are and going south to Karak. Jebel Shihan is just off the map here by Jada. So we're going to this site of Balua, a site that many of you know, I think, from trips with the friends in the past and other visits. As you're at Balua, you look back towards Jebel Shihan, and this site is very interesting for a number of reasons, one of which is its name. The name Balua, classical Arabic, means a water hole or gully or sinkhole. And Jebel Shihan, off there on the left-hand side, is at 1064.5 meters above sea level. And Balua is at 850 meters below sea level. So that Balua, the site, the region, is actually the drain for this part of the plateau. All the drainage from the foothills of Jebel Shihan and the surrounding areas, you can see, come down into this area and drain into the wadi where this site is located. And as you approach Balua, this is the site as you see it off in the distance. And here then is the Wadi Khuri, which becomes the gully or the drain for this whole part of the plateau. Now, the site is most famous for its qasr, this spectacular building of whatever function. Some suggest a temple, others a palace, others a fortress. Obviously, the name qasr is more in line with the military aspect. We don't know exactly what it was used for, nor do we know exactly when it was built. There were some excavations there last week. Those of you here remember I said that there were two soundings made in our region in 1933. The sounding made at Balua was by a British fellow named J.W. Crowfoot, believe it or not. And Crowfoot did his excavations there, but it's very clear from his article, which appeared in Palestine Exploration Quarterly, that he despised the site. He did not enjoy being there at all. If you read it, it's just depressing. If you ever feel good and you want to end up feeling bad very quickly, just read Crowfoot's report on Balua. He did some soundings, though, at the qasr in an effort to find out when this massive construction came into being. His conclusion was very much like that of Nelson Glick, who did his surface survey there after Crowfoot had done his soundings there. The conclusion was that its origin is in the Iron Age, perhaps Iron Age I, and then it was later reused, refurbished, rebuilt in the Nabataean period. So you have a variety of guesses with regard to its foundation. The structure is built out of basalt and limestone. There are large limestone lintels, thresholds, but most of it is built out of roughly dressed basalt. The plateau is strewn with basalt sectors because of the volcanic activity of Jebel Shihan. Now, the real reason for Crowfoot's excavation was that this monumental stela was discovered by the Department of Antiquities around 1930. by a fellow named Reginald Head. And some study was done on this. If you look on the handout I gave you, I've just made a copy of that for you, so you can see in a drawing what appears on the stela, or this pillar or slab. What you have on the handout is the lower part. There is an inscription on the upper part, though. Now, the most definitive study of the Balua stela was made by W.A. Ward and Martin, Egyptologists, who studied the inscription particularly, but also the clothing and the costumes, the stance, the symbolism that appears in the Balua stela. The conclusion was that this stela is an Egyptianizing monument carved by a non-Egyptian, probably a Moabite, someone living in the Balua vicinity, probably around 1200 BC. Now, they were able to say that on the basis of the costumes, and as I said, the symbolism. What you have in the picture, in the sunken relief, raised relief rather, is two deities in the company of a king. Now, the giveaway of a king is his headdress. This seems to be the kind of headdress worn in the late Bronze Age by residents of Transjordan, and these types of headdresses appear in Egyptian texts. The Egyptians referred in general to the people who lived in Transjordan as Shasu or Shutu. And this seems to be the kind of headdress worn by Shasu or Shutu in this period. And also then the other symbolisms, even such things as the length of the kilt, the wasp scepter, and other elements on the stela. So it's a very important piece of art. This piece of art, along with another piece of art found in our region, the Karak Plateau, the Shihan Warrior Stela, are the two oldest pieces of sculpture from Jordan, both of them probably dating from the late Bronze Age. So what we're saying is that around 1200 BC, Balua was significant enough to have come under Egyptian influence, artistic influence, probably some kind of economic contact. Only excavation can clarify exactly what we're speaking about. We know of many sites in Transjordan because of Egyptian documents, but Balua is not mentioned by that name, of course, and so we can only guess. This is the Wadi Khuri itself, which gives the site its name. It's a very impressive ravine. It's very small, but quite a beautiful gorge, and the water just must pour into it in the winter, this time of year, and then the wadi drains it off, but there are pools that stand in water all year long, so that this site is very important because of the available water, and then also there were springs nearby as well. The site is immense. It covers an area of approximately 750 meters by 150 meters. So it's an enormous site, surrounded in a very great number of places by walls. Here you can see these walls that run around the site, even above the steep gorge. Here are some of the walls laid up in very large basalt and limestone blocks, mortarless, of course. Again, the dating of such walls without excavation is impossible, virtually impossible. They may be Iron Age, they may be Nabataean, but Iron Age seems to be the best guess, especially since we do have this important document now, the Balua stela, to give this kind of connection. Crowfoot's project, by the way, there in 33 was intended to shed more light on the date and try to find more information about the Balua stela. He was totally unsuccessful. That may have contributed to his dislike of the site. Well, the Wadi Khuri is the dividing line between what we call Iron Age Balua on this side and then Early Bronze Age Balua on this side. Almost all the sherds that we found on this side dated to the last quarter of the third millennium, their early Bronze Age 4. About 85% of the sherds we picked up on that site dated to that period alone, early Bronze Age 4. So we're dealing here with two distinct sites, one on the south, one on the north. The Wadi Khuri then runs on down, runs into Wadi Balua, and then I showed this slide last week, the Wadi Balua joins up with Wadi Mujib, and then runs on out into the famous part of the Mujib that we all know from crossing it. Now the next site I'd like to move to is the site of Lejeune. I mentioned last week the important work of Tom Parker, the Central Limes Arabicus project. And because Tom and his team doing such a fine job there, we won't talk about the Roman site. We'll talk about the more important period, the early Bronze Age, when this country's history was forming, in fact. This is the very beginning of Moabite civilization, if we want to call the people who lived on this site Canaanites as well. It's the same time period we're speaking about. The site of Roman Lejeune is down in this plain near the spring, Ain Lejeune, but the early Bronze Age site doesn't appear on these maps. It's up on this ridge, very prominent ridge, but as I said, the Roman site has all the attention, and obviously it's very important. But I just want to draw your attention to this other site. Part of my mission in life is to draw people's attention to very unfamiliar sites, and Balua and Lejeune, E.B. Lejeune, are two of these sites, and I'd like for you to know this E.B. Lejeune. This, of course, is the Roman castle, or Tom's famous Quadriburgia, and above it is the E.B. site. This is taken from the E.B. site. If you go up on the E.B. site, you are impressed by the size. There is a 40-acre walled town on the ridge above the Roman camp. Now, this is one of the largest sites in the country in terms of being a walled town, 40 acres. And the walls are in different states of preservation. Here, Tom Schaub, of Baba Draw fame, is walking along one of the wall lines that is left. All of this is tumbled from the wall. Some of the walls, though, are in better state of preservation, standing up a number of courses high. And these are walls that probably are built, again, in the last quarter of the 3rd millennium B.C. Most of the sherds from Lejeune date to that time period. And again, we're only guessing, but if you find almost all sherds from one period, you can say that at least the major part of the living and construction of the site was in that period. Those walls were actually standing above this steep wadi, which surrounds the site on 2.5 sides. And then on the Roman side, the Roman camp side of the hill or the spur, the hill is less precipitous. But you can see why this was a naturally strategic position. And this is very important as we try to understand the early Bronze Age society in Jordan, because it has been said that early Bronze Age society was virtually nothing over here, while in Palestine, Western Palestine, the early Bronze Age IV culture flourished. And our contention is that with some 50 sites in our region alone, we have a very good representation from early Bronze Age IV, so that we have almost a theme and variation, we think, of early Bronze Age IV and earlier early Bronze Age periods represented, so that you have some of both on both sides, more or less a homogeneous culture. There is, of course, much illegal or illicit excavation at a site like this. The people in the neighborhood know that there are things up there that may be worth money, and so you have your usual amount of illegal excavations. But even more disturbing is the fact that E.B. Lejeune is not just used as a place to look for treasures, but it is being used today as a very convenient stone quarry, a source of cheap and ready-cut stone cut by people in the 3rd millennium B.C. And so you can understand why. You can go out there. It becomes very apparent to you when you realize that these roads go nowhere except to E.B. Lejeune. The roads are simply being used by local contractors who go in with heavy trucks, back right up on the Acropolis, a major fortified part of the site, and are hauling the site away by the truckload for the construction of modern houses. Again, you can understand why it's being done. It's a very cheap and easy source of stones, but it is a shame that this is occurring at such a rapid clip. Fortunately, the famous menhirs are still intact because they are in a very inaccessible place. Trucks can't get down here. Otherwise, these menhirs, these standing stones, which probably date to the end of the 3rd millennium B.C., these standing stones probably would have been carted off for foundations long ago. The exact function of such stones is still a mystery. Political, perhaps, religious, perhaps, economic, pact, and agreement between two neighboring city-states. There have been many things written on these standing stones, which you find all over this part of Transjordan, and yet we're not exactly sure what they are. Now, let's shift gears and come up into a more recent period. The third site, the site of Eder. The term, many of you know, the monastery, is a term that is applied to many sites, and often erroneously. As you know, in Petra, there is a place called the Monastery, which is not a monastery at all, but this is what the people in this region call this site that is out on this very inaccessible knob or knoll. What a good place for a monastery, in fact. This is as far to the west as you can go and still be in Moab. Just to the west of this would be the drop-off into the Dead Sea. And as I said, it is very inaccessible. This is just off the plateau to the west of Rabbah. And the villagers up here, many of them had never been out there. Some of them had been out there, though, with flocks and knew that there was something out there. And so we began our walk. It takes a couple of hours to get out there, walking out and then up this large shoulder, again walking up to the top. And once you're up there, you find the ruins are quite spectacular. Perhaps it was a monastery. There is a church up there, an absolute church, still intact. Some houses are still standing up higher than we stand. The interesting thing is that the pottery from this site ranges all the way from Chalcolithic down through the Ottoman period and has been virtually, occupied virtually throughout that period. The heaviest concentration of sherds comes from the Byzantine period, though. This may be what we would expect if, in fact, there was a monastery up here, or at least a Christian community. Again, the isolation of it, the presence of a church, the heavy concentration of the Byzantine period may lend some credibility to the name that has been attached to the site by the local people. The whole top of the hill is just honeycombed with cisterns of various sizes and shapes. You have to be very careful. You're walking around up there to be sure, or you can end up 12, 15 feet underground quickly. Some of the cisterns have steps that go down to them. Some of them are plastered, some of them not. Again, we don't date the cisterns just by looking at them, but if you want to see a variety of cistern uses, constructions, this would be the place. This, of course, is very important for this part of Transjordan because of the abundance of water that comes in across the rim of the plateau on the west has to be captured when it comes so that the occupants have that water throughout the year. So the capturing and use of water is something that we like to emphasize in such surface surveys as we've done. Now we come to two sites that are named the same, that almost look the same. In fact, there are three others in our region that have the same name, the name Medina, little city. This is a name that is ubiquitous. It's all over this part of the world. And this is a very interesting site. This is called Medina North in our terminology. This is the site that had soundings done on it by Emilio Olivari, the Spanish archaeologist, who did soundings here in 1976 and then again this last summer, 1982. The site is very interesting because it is a brother or sister to another site that is less than 5 kilometers immediately south that looks almost the same. In fact, Glick had found the one to the south in his 1933 survey. Glick had found Medina South, reported it. When Olivari went out to the region to do his excavations, he asked the local people, where is this place Medina? So they took him to this one, and he started his soundings here, thinking he was at Medina South. Olivari's talked about this quite openly, the mistake he made. It's an easy mistake. I have an aerial photograph of both sites, and you can lay them down side by side, and they look virtually the same, even from the air. So from the ground, the name is the same, they look the same, and the very same time period represented. This site, or these twin sites, are very important because they represent probably defensive points in Iron Age I. So these sites, both of these sites, were built around 1300 or in the early 1200s, were occupied for a brief time, and then were abandoned and destroyed. Olivari thinks that they were abandoned because of being put to the torch around 1200 BC, no later than 1175 BC. So this is a one-period site. Now, last week I mentioned that these sites are very important because they are one-period sites. You can, therefore, in excavation, come up with a good sequence of pottery. A material that dates to this period is very rare in this part of Transjordan that I'm speaking about. So this site is very important. It is a concentric circle ringed by two wall lines that run around it. You approach it on this spur that runs down to it. Then there's a dry moat that has been cut out of the rock here. Much of the stone then was used in the construction of the fortress. Here are the people standing along the rim. This is right on the edge now of Wadi Mujib on its northern course. This is before Wadi Mujib makes its western course. There's a tower that guards this dry moat as you come up. And then another one of the very important finds at the sites of Medina, both north and south, are the houses from this period, the Iron Age I. These houses are the so-called four-room houses. This is a very important discovery for Olivari, and we found them intact on the surface at Medina South. We're going to be looking at it in a minute, because the four-room house, which is really just three rooms running parallel and then one room running perpendicular across their top, called a four-room house. This has been allegedly the typical Israelite house of the Iron Age. And so now we have Israelite houses, so-called Israelite houses, in Moab, the far eastern side of Moab. And all we're saying is that this is not an Israelite-style building. This is an Iron Age-style building. And then again, you see this homogeneity of culture, even architectural styles, on both sides of the Jordan. So it's an Iron Age type of construction, the four-roomed house, where you have pillars running down through the center of the rooms because the beams that are available are not long enough to span one beam, so you have to have short beams running from pillar to pillar, and then you roof it over. So Olivari here on the left, very happy with his discoveries there. The only thing he's not happy with is that much of the pottery he's found there from the Iron Age is not clearly identifiable, as I said, because we don't have a complete understanding of the pottery from the late Bronze Iron Age I transition in this part of Transjordan. Max Miller on the right. This is the man who conceived our project and ran, as I said, for three summers in 78, 79, 82. Max Miller, a wonderful fellow. Sometime you ever get to meet him. I've asked Max Miller many times how a boy from Mississippi ever got to think like a German. He thinks like a German. He has an analytical, critical mind, and yet he's from Mississippi. I don't know how it happened, but we owe much to his inspiration and motivation. Now, one of the interesting things is about this Medina is that when you're up on the spur that runs down to it, if you look down Wadi Mujib, you can see Medina South, 4.5 kilometers to the south. You can see its dry moat, so that it is not inconceivable that these two sites were in signaling distance, visible to each other, either for smoke or fire. So you come out from Humud. The approach to Medina North is from Smakia. Out in this direction, it's 6 kilometers northeast of Smakia. You come to Medina South, is about 7 kilometers southeast of Humud. Here is where it's located. Notice again the strategic position out here on this little knob that juts out into the Wadi Mujib. It is quite inaccessible on three sides, and the approach from the west has been very carefully taken care of by the dry moat, by the walls, the towers, and again, it is quite a strategic position. Here it is as you approach it from the northwest. Again, notice the line of walls that rings the top of the site. Some of the walls are still standing 6 or 7 feet high and are 8 feet thick. Here one of our fellows is walking on the walls. You can see, of course, all this tumble, which would have been up higher. This site is so remote that even today it's not being carted off. There are no people that live out on this remote edge of the Moabite Plateau. Olivari suggests that these defensive walls, these towers, these fortresses, these citadels, as he calls them, were constructed as border fortresses for the Iron Age Moabites to protect their eastern edge, their perimeter, so that these are fortresses probably protecting the citizens who live further in. These fortresses probably were not densely occupied, but served as places of refuge in time of attack, or perhaps some kind of soldiers were stationed there for the protection of the citizens further in. Very similar to what Roman Lejeune did for the people who were further in the plateau. The fort out on the perimeter protecting the civilized people from the less civilized people who live further out. Here's the Wadi Mujib looking down from the walls. You can just imagine here that on so many days, the men who lived here would send the women down to get water. Then when the women would come back, the men would go down for fishing or hunting or something. It must have been a very nice life, except in time of war. But otherwise, this fortress would have been quite an unusual place to live. Now, here are some lintels from these Iron Age houses still intact. These are lintels that would have supported ceilings, either for two-story houses or these houses built right up into the wall. So these lintels are standing, and Jim here, the fellow is standing, in a fill of a room that if it were lowered, say 4 or 5 feet, you'd be standing on the floor of an Iron Age house. So this is Iron Age fortifications and houses just virtually standing intact yet today. Now, we change, leave Medanus behind and come to a site called Kirbit Birgis. Tom Schaub and Walt Rass were able to get the name of this site. We visited there many times and finally got a name for it. Birgis is this site. It is located near the town of Batir. Anybody knows the region between Rakhine and Batir? This is the site. This ash-colored small tell. It's ash-colored because of ash, because of the occupation that's been there. It is a small tell. It measures 75 meters north-south by 150 meters east-west. So it is a tell of some several meters depth, probably built on this natural hill. Part of the site has been cut away by the road that runs between Rakhine and Batir, Batir right up here on this hillside. Because the modern town of Batir is so nearby, as you can see, the local fields are heavily farmed, and this has led to the discovery of much of the pottery. This site is interesting. Me and others, including Tom Shaw, because it seems to be almost wholly an early Bronze Age town. It stands above this deep wadi, the Wadi Siwan, which makes its way down then to the Dead Sea. And this site sits on the saddle where two wadis are formed. On one side, a wadi goes down to the Dead Sea. On the other side, a wadi runs toward Rabba, so that there would be much drainage in the hillsides nearby and allow for very good agriculture here because of the drainage. Here Tom is walking around some of these walls that surround the site. My wife says she doesn't see a wall there, but you got to be there. If you're there, you can see it. And it's much clearer in this shot, I'll admit. Here you see the outer edge of the wall, the inner edge of the wall, perhaps 2 meters across. And we're looking at the tops of the walls or foundations that are left, perhaps with mud brick superstructure or perhaps stone. But some kind of walled town here, 75 by 150 meters. Now, the interesting thing about this site is that instead of being early Bronze IV in the dominant pottery that came off the surface, it is predominantly early Bronze II-III. 75% of the pottery we picked up here, over 200 sherds, are from early Bronze II-III. So from the beginning to the middle of the third millennium BC. So we're taking back the history of the Moabites even further at this point. And again, it's a walled town. Here again is one of these menhirs. We call them standing stones, but you can't really call this one a standing stone. It used to be standing, but of course now it has fallen. We were actually taking our lunch on this stone, and we said, wait a minute, look what we're sitting on. And we realized that we were sitting on one of these roughly carved menhirs, or standing stones, just like we saw back at Lejeune, the line of them. This one is very interesting. It is almost 5 meters long and 1.75 meters wide, and it sat in a socket, a stone socket. There was a large dowel or pin that would have rested in this socket. And so a very large menhir at this EB site, what we would expect. Now we come down to the very southern end of the plateau, and I'd like to come to the site of Kirbit El Mudawara. Something round, something circle, like the traffic circles. And here's the site, something oval perhaps. Round is close. Here's the site. It is again strategically located on an isolated hill that is very well protected on three sides. It can be only approached only on the east. And this is the same way that the modern tractors go up to the top of a site to plow. So it's still the way You would approach the site in antiquity. This would be the way the road would lead up, because this is where the main part of the wall survives and the gateways. Here's the site from the south. You can see the wall line, again, running around the rim of the hill. This is an early Bronze Age site. Again, I'm going back into that third millennium. I happen to have more slides of early Bronze Age sites, and so I picked these. At some points, as I said, the walls are still in good states of preservation. Most of the pottery from the site is Bronze Age. There is some pottery from the Iron Age, but very little. So without much question, this fortress or this walled town was an early Bronze Age town. Again, we're saying the third millennium BC, Moabite culture was much more sophisticated than we perhaps have been led to think in past years. Now we come to the site of Medabi. The site of Medabi is far in the southeastern part of the plateau. Here we're approaching it from the north. This would be the way you would come to it if you turned off south off of the Karakatrana Highway. Karakatrana, then turned south through the Faj, or that Great Depression that runs down through the Karak Plateau. It's a very interesting site because, again, it is probably Iron Age Nabataean rebuild. It is an Iron Age site because the sherds that come from the surface are largely Iron Age, but also the type of construction, the header stretcher construction, where you lay up the stones in such fashion that you put the heads out two and then put a stretcher, and then heads out two. This bonds the wall together, and you don't need mortar. It's a very inexpensive way to build, very quick way to build, and also very stable. This fortress is roughly square, and its periods of occupation, as I said, primarily Iron Age and Nabataean. There are other sherds there, though. There are even some Byzantine Roman sherds there. When Glick visited this site in 1933, he said there were remains of a Nabataean dam in the wadi to the north of Medabi. Well, today there is a modern reservoir in the wadi to the north of Medabi, so the Nabataean engineers, water conservationists, built their dam in the same place the modern engineers decided was a good place to catch the water also. The ruins at Medabi are in a fairly disheveled state because there's much modern occupation, Bedouin occupation, and they have rearranged the stones and the walls and the interior for sheep enclosures. So they're not tearing things up, they're just rearranging for modern use. Now last week I showed this slide, and if you look at the other handout that I've given you, I'd like to dwell on this for a minute. This is called a proto-Ionic capital or proto-Aeolic capital, and on the left-hand side of the sheet, here are some other examples of these capitals from other sites. A is from Megiddo and Samaria. They look the same. B from Megiddo. C from Megiddo. D from the site of Hazor. And then E, very bottom, a capital or pilaster cap on the left-hand bottom corner. The capitals from Ramat Hill near Jerusalem, Jerusalem and Medabi. Now, this is very interesting because there are 34 of these proto-Aeolic capitals, or proto-Ionic capitals, 34 of them known from Palestine. 33 of them are known in western Palestine, one known in eastern Palestine, this one at Medabi. There are actually two more here, fragments, so that we now know there are three at Medabi. Now, what is that saying? Again, we're speaking about style of architecture, construction technique from the Iron Age that can be found on both sides of the Jordan in the Iron Age. On the right-hand side, you see how these pilaster caps were used. They were not the type of capital that you might think of in Greek and Roman architecture, but more or less built into a wall or a freestanding to support roof beam or beam for a monumental gateway. In fact, at Medabi, there are gates on both the east and west. They are limestone gates, whereas the rest of Medabi is built out of basalt. Again, this volcanic black rock. And the monumental gateway is built out of limestone. So, again, we're looking at a type of construction that is found on both sides. And this side of Medebi probably will be excavated in the near future. A Spanish team is interested in excavation there. And especially they're interested in the gateway, because we don't have good monumental gateways from the Iron Age anywhere in Transjordan. And this is a place where certainly there is one and perhaps two still intact. So because of this capital, or this pilaster cap, this site has been designated as one that will probably come under excavation in the very near future. And of course, that's what we're trying to do. Then we come to another site, Rujum al-Ghlib, this is a site that we kind of like. I say we, Tom, Shahab, and I here, located right here at the head of Wadi Masar. So when you come across the Mujib, you come up onto the rim, and not long after you're heading south towards Jebel Shihan here, you'll look off to the right and see this site, if you know where to look for it. Otherwise, it's fairly inconspicuous. Here it is here. Notice how it is situated to take advantage of the drainage on both sides as the wadi is formed. Wadi Masar is formed by the drainage off the plateau and, of course, then the fertile fields all around it. The mysterious thing about the site would be, of course, its function. What in the world is this? Is it a village or just a few houses? What, defensive point? Nelson Glick said that surely this guarded the approach to the Wadi Mujib. Nelson Glick has forts all over the plateau guarding the approach to the Wadi Mujib, as if someone were going to sneak up and steal the Wadi Mujib. We don't know if there were so many defensive points. Perhaps it's a religious center or agricultural center. We just don't know. But there is an artificial tell there, largely built of basalt, that is situated in a very interesting place. And the ruins are scattered about. It, again, is primarily early Bronze Age in its remains. In fact, almost, over half early Bronze 2, 3 alone. So, again, we're back in the first half of the third millennium for this site. There are some Nabataean shurs here also. So some have suggested that this is an early Bronze Age site that was reoccupied by the Nabataeans and rearranged in the fashion that we see it here. But the site is mysterious in terms of what in the world its function may have been. It's such a small site in an unusual position. And then last but not least, come to site number 10, the site of Marega. I showed this one last week also with regard to the cemetery there, and I wanted to say more about Marega. Now this is that faj that you see, the faj or an entrance into the southeastern part of the plateau. You see this great depression, it's a geological fault. As you're coming down the hill from Rabah, just before you come to the junction with Karak-Katrana Highway. Any of you have driven down through there? As you're coming down from the road from Rabah to the Karak-Katrana Highway junction, if you look off in this direction there, look off to the southeast, you will see this faj, El Isaker, or the Wadi Batra. And the site of Marega sits near the mouth of this site, of this faj, rather. There are a number of sites that line the rim on both sides of the faj. Here is the faj as you're coming down that hill. Now, Karak would be over here to my right, and this is the faj. And here's Marega situated right here. You can see it once you know where it is, on this very prominent position, guarding the entrance or the exit, whatever you might want to call it. Just depends on which direction you're going, I suppose. We suspect that it was used as a trade route in antiquity. It is a very nice way to go deep into the heart of the plateau. And here is the site as you approach now. It is, in fact, a walled town from the Byzantine period. As you can see, many of the remains stand intact. The site measures about 80 meters by 75 meters, so it's almost a square. It's a walled town surrounded by relatively fertile fields. The site is surrounded by a very sophisticated water catchment and cistern system. On one side, there is a line of 12 cisterns that all have a system set up to allow the drainage off the slope to come into the cisterns. Undoubtedly, this dates to the Roman Byzantine period. Most of the sherds from the site are early Byzantine. We collected at this site almost 3,500 sherds, discarded many, many of them as undiagnostic, but then came up with the largest majority of them being Nabataean and early Byzantine. These people, we know, were very good farmers, so it's not unusual to find this kind of site located in an area that can be farmed, and also for commercial contact. You know, the Nabataeans were quite interested in this kind of activity. And there are many other large Nabataean sites in the area. One site that I didn't show you, the site of Nechel, is a huge, huge Nabataean town. There are a number of religious structures there. Nabataean, Byzantine, I should say, Roman Byzantine. There are temples there, churches there. It's a huge site. I don't want to compare it to Umm al-Jamal. I don't want to, but I almost have to. It's like Umm al-Jamal, but perhaps not as spectacular as it, but it's a large site. Perhaps it was in contact with Moraga. Glick suggests that they were both important centers of trade to the Nabataeans. The thing, though, that I pointed out last week was the fact that here at Moraga, this large town, you have this cemetery that has been looted. These are Byzantine tombs that have been dug out. I don't know how many. We didn't count. Certainly scores of them. We visited here on a number of occasions during a month period, and the robbing was still going on during the time we were there. Fresh tombs would be open. Dr. Hadidi from the Department of Antiquities went down and is aware of the situation. But again, there are so many sites in Jordan, and they're so accessible. There's just really not much that can be done. The interesting thing we found is that there were virtually no artifacts left in this robbed cemetery. I think we found one piece of pottery all the times we walked there. The most commonly found artifact would be flashlight batteries, because tomb robbers, of course, working at night. And Tom and I also found an iron rod that the tomb robbers used to drive into the ground to strike the stone cavity where the tomb is. Then they know where to dig. Tremendous amount of labor. If this labor could have been funneled into proper excavation, the site could be a tourist attraction today. Tremendous amount of labor. Some of these holes, as you can see, digging down to the tombs, are several meters deep. The rod is driven into the ground with a hammer, and then it strikes the stone-lined cavity where the tomb is. The robbers then know how to dig down certainly quickly, and then sledgehammering their way through the top of the tomb, probably finding Byzantine glass vessels and pottery. But this material then appears for sale in black market and so forth. Many, many of the tombs just like this. Again, the amount of work. And they leave their evidence, other activity, skull caps and human bones strewn all over this cemetery. And this is the kind of thing that our survey was designed to help discover in part, so that it would not continue, or that at least it could be slowed down, because these sites are there in such large number, and we just hate to see them disappear. Last week I mentioned in closing that we feel like we have just laid a foundation, putting these sites on the map, some 585 of them, and hope now that other teams, other expeditions from the department, from the universities here, or from other countries, will have enough curiosity to come in to fill in some of the gaps in information that still exists with regard to the history of this region, and then tie this region's history into the broader context of the Middle East. So those are the 10 sites, and I hope that you feel like they're, if not the top 10, at least 10 good ones. And some other time, we'll look at the other 575 of them. Thank you all. David, we made the one announcement at the beginning about the lecture at the British Council on February the 7th.
Okay. Yeah, I want to apologize. I meant to be down here to introduce Jerry and also to make some announcements, but I got a call from the States right as the lecture began, and it lasted for 30 minutes. So I just want to say, for those of you who may not have been here last year, this is kind of, or last week, it's kind of late to introduce Jerry, but just to recognize the fact that Jerry is a professor of biblical studies and archaeology in the United States at Knoxville. And he's here in Jordan for the entire year on an NEH, or National Endowments for the Humanities Fellowships. He's been teaching at the University of Jordan this last term, or had a seminar that met at the university and here. And we've got a course coming up at ACOR that will start on the 9th. I think you've got some announcements that you may have seen. Jerry will also be contributing to that course. I also failed to mention last week, and partly because she wasn't here, Jerry's wife, Pam, is also with him in Jordan for the year. She's sitting back by the door, and she's the ACOR librarian. So anybody who stays at ACOR, we put it to work. One other thing, Tom Schaub, the director of the Baba Draw excavations, has asked me to make an announcement. And that is, he's going to be in the country only a couple more weeks. And he's got a lot of pottery from Baba Draw, the Bronze Age site near the south end of the Dead Sea, that needs to be drawn. And he would very much like to have some volunteers who would be willing to come by for, I think, Tom, just a couple of weeks to work on the drawings. Next Friday, or this coming Friday, which is the 4th, at 10:30 is when he would like to have people here. Jennifer Coward, who's right back by the museum case. You want to stand for just a second, Jennifer? Jennifer is the draftsperson for the ACOR team at Jerash and has a lot of experience, professional experience in drafting. And if you are interested in volunteering, she will be giving you lessons. I think it would certainly help Dr. Schaub out to have some people volunteer, and it would be, I think, very interesting and valuable experience to learn how pottery is drawn through your service.
Friday?
This coming Friday. Friday the 4th at 10:30 in the morning. Right? So I urge you to take advantage of that. One other quick announcement here. I'd like to introduce a couple other people that you may have seen around this.